cartwheels across the floor. I was feeling kind of seasick. The crowd called out for more. The room was humming harder as the ceiling flew away. Well, they called out for another drink. The waitress brought the tray. And so it was later as the mirror told its tale.
Truth is plain to see, but I wondered, why am I playing cards? Just would not let her be one of 16 Vestal virgins. We're leaving for the coast. Although both my eyes were wide open, they might just as well be closed.
And so it was the later as the mirror told its tale. Turned a whiter shade.
This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC. My guest this month is Richard Vine, but before going to the interview, I want to read a written statement about his talk coming up on the 6th of August at the school in Kinderhook. Art, Crime, and Soho Sins. Throughout history, art and crime have been deeply intertwined. Not only have artworks been the target of criminal behavior, principally vandalism, theft, and forgery, they have also frequently taken crimes as their subject matter. For example, various old master depictions of the Rape of Helen, David's The Death of Marat, Warhol's 13 Most Wanted Men, Ouija's murder victim photographs, Mike Kelly's installation in response to serial killer John Wayne Gacy. Equally disturbing, artworks themselves have often been regarded as criminal acts, accused of sacrilege. Martin Scorsese's Last Temptation of Christ, obscenity, works by Serrano, Mapplethorpe, Ophelia, and others. Treason, Dred Scott's What is the Proper Way to Display a U.S. Flag, and other malfeasance. Finally, such recent events as the fraud charges brought against New York dealer Lawrence Solander, the false attributions trial of Nolder Gallery personnel, and the release of the Panama Papers, confirming financial chicanery among top collectors, prompt one to ask if the contemporary art world is itself, in many respects, a criminal enterprise. Is the flow of stupendous wealth through a largely unregulated global art system a ready prescription for legal, to say nothing of moral, wrongdoing? Is there some deep link between hardcore crime and the aesthetic rule-breaking and outlaw imaginative freedom that we routinely associate with artistic creativity? In conjunction with the release of his art world crime novel, Soho Sins, Richard Vine, the longtime managing editor of Art in America, will succinctly analyze these and other related issues, drawing equally from art history, the news, and his own noir fiction.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so blue. I knew you'd love me as long you wanted, and then someday you'd leave me for somebody new. Worry, why do I? Thinking that my love could hold you, I'm crazy for trying and crazy for crying, and I'm crazy for loving you. Crazy for thinking that my
this is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC, and my guest this month is Richard Vine, the author, art critic, and novelist. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Now, you're going to be giving a talk in Kinderhook quite soon at the school on the subject of art and crime.
Yes. Of course, this is an interest that stems out of my own recent writing, having just published this crime novel set in the New York art world. But I became intrigued by the longer history and the larger issue of art and crime as well. The fact that a great deal of art has crime as a subject. Art itself, of course, is subject to theft, to forgery, other kinds of malfeasance. And one could even begin to look at the art world as a kind of criminal enterprise, or as an enterprise that has criminal elements. So all of those factors will be discussed in the presentation, as well as my own novel.
Now, the novel, which is called Soho Sins,
yes.
How long did you work on that?
A long time, because I have a full-time job. You know, I'm the managing editor of Art in America. So my typical day is 8 hours in the office, and then going out to openings, and then to dinner with artists, and then coming home at, you know, 11 o'clock at night and scribbling for 45 minutes. So there was at least 5 years of that, probably more. And at first, you know, sort of random notes, little scenes, exchanges of dialogue, things I remembered, things I observed. And at a certain point, of course, you realize, wait a minute, this is accumulating into something and needs to be shaped. And that process, the shaping process, took about a year, again, working full-time and doing the writing on the edges, on the fringes.
Well, it seems very well written and very well put together. Right. So you must have had some experience reading a lot of novels.
Well, I'm originally a literature type. I have a PhD from the University of Chicago, where my specialty was contemporary American fiction, not writing it, but analyzing and teaching it. So, yes, and there was a period also in my life when I was in Saudi Arabia for a year teaching there, surrounded by desert, you know, 400 miles on every side, and I fell into reading crime fiction at that time as a great escape. And, you know, read many of the classic authors. So that was kind of buried in my subconscious for many years thereafter and reemerged recently.
Many of the settings and situations are familiar to anyone who's lived in New York City. Did you also use certain artists as sort of models or inspiration?
Yeah. For the most part, the characters are the usual mishmash of, you know, elements taken from one person and fused with those from another, or entirely fabricated. There are two characters that are direct transcriptions from life, one of whom is an artist in the book called The Viking, who is a sculptor from Iceland, based very directly on a friend of mine named Gudjon Bjarnason, who now lives in India, of all things. And the other true-to-life character, so to speak, is, surprisingly, Sammy, this would-be mafioso figure, who is based on a real person that I knew many years ago in Chicago when I was in the advertising business. And Sammy was, you know, a facilitator. When you needed things done, you called Sammy.
There's so many twists and turns and surprises in the plot. How did those kind of develop out of the writing? How does that all happen?
I probably did it all wrong, you know, going at this as an amateur. I made a decision early on in the writing process not to let myself know who did it. Because I figured if I knew too early on, I would tip my hand and spoil the experience for the reader. And so I kept myself in the dark literally all the way through until the very end. And then I decided, okay, now.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. And they all seem very convincing perps, yeah. Along the way.
Yeah. You know, most of the suspects are artists. One is a 28-year-old Italian painter named Claudia Silva, whose father was a museum director. Another is a pretty boy named Paul Morse, who is a video artist and involved with the downtown nightlife scene. A third is a woman named Angela, who is the first wife of the man whose second wife is killed, and the mother of their daughter. and mother and daughter were abandoned years ago by Philip, the one of the main characters. The only major suspect who's not an artist is named Bob Andrews, and he's the chief financial officer of Philip's company, which is a high-tech company called OTEC, short for Oliver Industries. Philip is Philip Oliver, the son of an old Rust Belt tycoon who, you know, with his father's help, launched a new branch, a high-tech endeavor that was wildly successful, and you know, he's now ridiculously rich. Of course, there's a lot of real-life observation, particularly the situation of a single mother raising a daughter in this very peculiar art world environment. I know several people who have been in that situation and the challenges that they faced. I had great admiration for them because they ended up doing a splendid job in both cases that I can think of. But it creates all of these fictional possibilities, which I exploit.
And you also comment on changes in the art world over the years.
Yes, particularly the growing influence of money. In the character's memory, we begin with the art world, the Soho of late 60s, the 70s, you know, where people were living on the sly in these kind of rat trap environments, hiding from the building inspectors and, you know, and disguising things as cabinets when there were really roll-out beds and, you know, all of that. And living this very exciting but also very earnest life of art making. And slowly over time, in the course of the novel and in the course of the memories of the people involved, you see that world transformed into one that's utterly infused with money and the pursuit of money and the calculations about, you know, which artist is going to produce financially and which one isn't. And a great shift from a gallery system in which dealers took full responsibility for presenting their artists to one in which artists are very often asked to share expenses so that, you know, the last possible dollar can be squeezed out of what they do. And like a lot of people in my generation, I was saddened and disturbed by that change. And I have very serious questions about its effect not only on the life of artists, but on what they produce. Because it seems to me at this point, artists have a choice either to give up on the commercial aspects of the art world and dedicate themselves in a very altruistic way to their work, or to play the game and become calculating and make work for the market, for the collector. Not that they would admit that in very direct terms, but it's very evident that that's what's happening and that's what succeeds at the top of the market. And the system has become all about the top of the market. There was a recent statistic released by the European Art Fair Association, which keeps a tally of prices around the world. I think it was a year or so ago. They calculated that one half of 1% of all of the art bought and sold accounts for 46% of the market.
Wow.
So you can see the enormous pressure to be one of those. It's much the same in the publishing business today. It's much the same in movies, et cetera. And I think we need to ask ourselves what that is doing to us as artists and what it's doing to the art we produce. Except that it's probably not good. Yeah, maybe that's why I have this proclivity for a sort of open-ended approach. Readers will find when they complete the novel that there's a good deal of ambiguity, a good deal of uncertainty, which in some ways violates the expectations of this kind of fiction. But all of that is very intentional and I think very much to the point about the current situation.
This is certainly true. I mean, I'm still not completely convinced who did this.
Yes. Good. Well, maybe we should describe the situation a little bit. Basically, this is a story narrated by a dealer named Jackson Wyeth, who has a very successful gallery in Soho in the 90s and also owns 7 residential buildings in the area. And one of his best friends and best clients is Philip Oliver, the high-tech mogul, whose wife is murdered in their loft in Soho. Whereupon Philip goes to the police with a very peculiar semi-confession. He walks into the police station and says, "Hello, my name is Philip Oliver, and I believe I murdered my wife." And of course, it's that "I believe." That's the essential question. Did you in fact kill your wife? And to determine that and to protect his friend, Jackson brings into the scene his old friend, Ed Hogan, who was known simply as Hogan by everyone. Hogan is a former Marine, a former NYPD homicide detective, now a private investigator. And the two of them set out together to try to solve the mystery and to save Jackson's friend, Philip. That device, of course, allows us to take parallel views of the art world simultaneously, because you have the insider view from Jackson Wyeth, who is thoroughly inculcated with art world experiences and values and vocabulary and thoroughly world-weary and cynical. And then you have the view from the outside via Hogan, who is a normal guy, a regular guy, and finds all of this very peculiar, often distasteful, and yet, of course, like many people, is deeply fascinated at the same time. And I like the fact that we don't have to settle on one perspective or the other, but that, you know, the beauty of the experience lies in the vacillation between those perspectives. You know, Hogan is world-weary and cynical in his own way, but for different reasons and to rather different effect. He, in fact, is quite religious in nature, a practicing Catholic, very unlike Jackson, who is, you know, atheist beyond any reach of faith or righteousness, and yet, for some reason, feels compelled to try to set things right. The nature of the universe in which this takes place is itself highly corrupt. The critic and bookstore owner, Otto Penzler, has a very interesting distinction that he makes between detective fiction and noir fiction. He says in detective fiction, you essentially have the knight in shining armor, the man on the white horse, you know, who comes in to a disturbed scene, and through his tenaciousness and his intelligence and his moral rectitude, eventually solves the mystery and sets things right, you know, damaged as he may be and imperfect as he may be. On the other hand, in true noir fiction, you have a universe which is unredeemed and probably unredeemable. Everywhere you turn, the characters are corrupt. Every system is set up for the advantage of someone whose motivations are less than pristine. One can solve the mystery. One can determine, you know, who did it. But one cannot deliver salvation in this situation. And the story also has other elements, you know, the sort of woman in jeopardy element. Obviously, with Jack and Hogan, the kind of buddy story, the social satire on the art world. So I try to keep a lot of balls in the air at the same time, so that the reader is never bored. And I operate in writing and in presenting the story with this kind of notion of qi. I travel a lot to China, and I've written a lot about Chinese art. And in traditional Chinese practice, the painters had this notion of qi, or energy, which they thought, you know, infused the world, but also infused an artwork, and by virtue of your strokes and the movement down or across the scroll, you released the chi in continuing waves. And, you know, although I don't believe in chi literally, I find it very useful as a metaphor, as a thinking device for how to present action and scenes and experiences to the reader, constantly trying to draw you along.
Now, I noticed that you'd written a book about New China art.
Yes.
Do the same conditions prevail in China as in the New York scene?
They're even more extreme, if you can imagine. China, because it was closed for 30 or 35 years, essentially skipped the evolution of modernism. They went from traditional practice to a period of being insulated and isolated for 30 or 35 years, and then suddenly opened up to the new world of postmodernism, when everything is simultaneously available, equally valid or invalid. And if you're an artist, you have a kind of Chinese menu experience where you can say, all right, I'll use a little pointillism and combine that with some German expressionism and what have you. And they entered this scene at a time when the money corruption had already begun and indeed was beginning to peak. So although artists there have a real deep historical story to tell, particularly the artists that I wrote about from the previous generation who went through the Cultural Revolution, once they enter the contemporary scene, there's very little to ground them or restrain them, because they spent 3 decades being told to, you know, forget the past, subscribe to the thinking of Mao. Once Mao went away and Mao thought became no longer valid, they were left then with the contemporary world of luxury goods and consumerism. And so, you know, calculating for what will work in the market is just ingrained in younger artists there. And at the same time, there's a lot of manipulation within the market, not just collectors buying purely for speculation, but actually, you know, attempting to rig the system so that their investments will pay off. You can have buying rings at auctions and things of that nature.
When did you start traveling to China or being
interested? That was in the year 2000. It was a roundabout experience, as so many are in my life. I was visiting an artist residency program in Poland, staying there for about 10 days as an observer and a critic. They had invited about 100 artists from all around the world to make work on site in a small city in Poland, Bydgoszcz. And among them was a Chinese artist, a sculptor who was married to an American artist, also a sculptor. We struck up a friendship. He invited me to come to the Shanghai Biennale in 2000. And that was a turning point in Chinese art. It was the first time that the Shanghai Biennale became truly international. Before that, it was a showcase for Chinese art. When Ho Hanru curated it in the year 2000, he opened it up to the entire world. And it also inspired a number of independent shows put on by other curators or groups of artists, which were in many ways more interesting than the official biennial, because it had certain government restraints, which they did not. The most famous of those shows was co-curated by Feng Bui and the artist Ai Weiwei, who subsequently became very famous. And that show had a title that you probably can't use on the air. In Chinese, it means something like uncooperative attitude. But the English translation that they gave it was about effing off, you know. Uh-huh. And that pretty well expressed the attitude of the curators and of the artists who participated. But it was, as you can imagine, a galvanizing show, amazing work, free and bold in a way that perhaps only people who have previously been repressed can be. And from that point, I started going back to China two or three times each year, writing a lot of articles, and then eventually the book, New China, New Art, which traces the emergence of the avant-garde from the death of Mao in 76 to about the year 2010.
How did you end up as an art critic?
By a very circuitous route, I have to say. I grew up in a place very removed from the contemporary art world, very removed from any art.
Where was that?
That was in rural Ohio, and it's not a town, a township, a crossroads in the countryside called Mecca, Ohio, on the banks of Mosquito Lake. The place was so small, we didn't even have our own post office. We had to use the post office of the next township over. And I had a very Huck Finn-like existence there growing up as a boy, which I loved at the time. But then, you know, adolescence hit. And I found myself standing at the kitchen window and looking out over the fields to the tree line and thinking, there's got to be something more somewhere, So I went on, to college and then to the University of Chicago studying literature. And afterwards was teaching here and there, in Saudi Arabia, but also various schools in the Chicago area. One of which was the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and that's how I got hooked into the contemporary art scene. Firsthand, directly, I never studied art history. I just started meeting artists and eventually married a woman who was a curator, which meant that my entire social and personal life was in the art world. And the artists that I knew at that time were the Harry Hu artists, the Chicago Imagists, Roger Brown and Carl Wiersum and Jim Nutt, a pretty strange group of people, not personally strange, but producing an art that to this day is very striking and that deals with issues of sex and violence in a very charming and often humorous manner. And then at a certain point in my life, I became editor-in-chief of a regional art magazine called Dialogue, which covered seven states in the Midwest. And after doing that for about a year, I made the leap to Art in America in New York. And that was in 1988.
You were mostly concerned with New York art from that point?
No. I would say probably the majority of my own writing about art deals with artists outside of New York and outside of the United States. So I've written about the Norwegian figurative painter Odd Nerdrum. I've written about many, many Chinese artists, Korean artists, a few Japanese, South American, and I've been fortunate enough to be able to travel to all of these places. I make maybe, four or five foreign trips a year. On the other hand, my daily life is very much in New York. I've always been a new downtown New York guy from the time I arrived 28 years ago. I lived first in Chelsea, then in Tribeca, now in the West Village. The office is in Soho. I can walk to Chelsea from my doorstep. So that has always been my environment.
Did the art change when it moved to Chelsea?
Oh, sure. At least the art environment changed. As the spaces get bigger, the economic structure has to shift to accommodate, to pay for those spaces. So there came to be, as we noted earlier, this greater and greater emphasis on the big producers, the high earners, and also larger scale art just fill the spaces, which is not to say that all other kinds of art doesn't go on. It certainly does, and you know, meaning, you know, art on a small scale, art that is not high priced. All of that is still being produced, still being consumed, still being written about. But realistically, what drives the system economically is this other species of art.
Is there anything going on now that's kind of analogous to the early East Village scene?
Well, yeah, if you go far enough out in Brooklyn, for many years now, first it was Williamsburg and then Dumbo and then Bushwick, and now there are more and more places that I can't even name. And yes, there's an entire alternative world out there. And I noticed that when we get submissions these days, writers, artists, very, very often identify themselves as living in Brooklyn. They don't say, I live in New York. They say, I live in Brooklyn. And there's, along with this geographic shift, there's also a shift towards a kind of DIY mentality, a do-it-yourself approach, because people realize that entering the formal gallery system is not only very difficult, it also drastically affects what you produce. So if you either cannot enter that system or prefer not to enter it, then you have to make your own way. And so there are many, many, artist-run spaces, artist groups that sort of form and dissolve, people presenting their own work in their own spaces, and none of that is considered illegitimate. In fact, it's considered of great interest.
And how do people make the leap from that scene to...
If I could answer that, I'd be a very rich man. After all these years in the art world, I still don't know the answer to that question. I'm not sure anyone does. I know how you can increase your odds. You go to one of six important art schools. You make a lot of connections while you're in art school, and subsequently, you live in the right kind of neighborhood, one of those Brooklyn neighborhoods. You hang out with those people. You develop a certain sensibility, a certain vocabulary, a certain frame of reference. All of that gives dealers the sense that, yes, you're the genuine article. You're our kind of person. But how out of, 100 people that meet that description, they then select one? I think it's a little like dating. Yes, you could sit down and make a list, must be 6'2", must earn at least, $100,000 or whatever. But in fact, most people don't operate that way. In fact, you encounter people and you have a reaction. And I think it's very much the same for dealers when they meet artists. Either there's a chemistry or there isn't.
And are these big-time dealers accessible?
To whom? No, it's very difficult for an artist to just come in cold. I mean, it's not as though you can walk in off the street and, scroll. You can, you can try. You can go up to the counter and say, hi, I'd like to speak to, big dealer so-and-so. But you won't have much success. The art world is still very much a word-of-mouth business. It's still very much a matter of who knows whom, who quietly says in someone's ear, I saw some work by such and so the other day. I think he really, has promise. You might want to check him out. And then, of course, at the other end of the business, away from the artist and the commercial end of the business, the big collectors have access to big dealers and vice versa. Some of the people who have read advanced copies of the book and whatnot have asked me about this duality between Jack and Hogan, sort of why it's there, and how I had the resources to to develop both perspectives. And I think ultimately that's very personal. You know, I've spent many years in the art world, but I came from a background which was extremely different. Growing up, I lived next door to my grandfather, who was originally a Welsh coal miner who went into the pits when he was 12 years old. My father was one of 11 children who dropped out in the eighth grade to go to work to help support his family and began his working life as a boxer. But both of these men had a deep appreciation for literature and for learning, in part because they missed it, perhaps, you know. But it was more than that. It was, a sincere and genuine love and appreciation. They didn't have exposure to, the high literature that I was schooled in eventually, but they had the King James Version of the Bible, which ain't bad.
That's true.
They had hymns. They had 19th century narrative poetry. And my Welsh grandfather was a great storyteller, a great reciter of poetry. The Welsh, as you probably know, have a deep tradition of honoring the voice, honoring storytelling, honoring singing, honoring recitation. And my father, who eventually became a kind of labor representative and eventually a supervisor in a factory, used to get up at 4:30 in the morning so that he could have 20 minutes, half an hour to read in the morning before he went to work for his 7 a.m. shift. And that's one of my earliest memories, is seeing him in that chair early in the morning reading and taking notes. And our house was full of little pieces of paper where he wrote down his reactions to the things he read. So my notion of art and masculinity are deeply intertwined. There was never any distinction for me between, the manly man and the literary man. They were one and the same. And I also had an appreciation for the no-nonsense, well-grounded view of the world that such men have. when you work 8 or 10 hours a day in a factory, you don't suffer fools lightly. You better give it to me straight. And at the same time, these men retained a great appreciation for beauty, and particularly the beauty of language. But I'm also struck, thinking back on those things, about the peculiarity of those literary sources. I mean, if you think about the King James Version of the Bible or the words of some of those hymns, they're extremely beautiful, but they're also extremely stark and peculiar. You're 5 years old, sitting there and hearing the minister say, "Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb?" What? closing a sermon, "Just as I am without one plea, but that thy blood was shed for thee." But of course, the story of the New Testament is the story of blood atonement. And you don't have to dig very, very deep to see the connection there to noir fiction, to murder mystery, and to the implicit hope of redemption in noir fiction, even if it's never realized. Oddly, I found that one of the things I had to do in the editing process was to rough up my language in certain places. Because, my first love was like romantic poetry. So it's very natural for me to write kind of, fluid passages with mellifluous language. But that's not what you need in this circumstance. You need something that's poetically inflected, but extremely grounded in reality. I always say that, crime fiction melds two major elements. One is the nitty-gritty, the close observation of everyday life, you know, right down to I saw the sand under her fingernails and I knew she must have been on the beach that Tuesday, right? And but that is melded, that's the texture, but it's placed on a structure which is really mythic. It's a fairy tale structure. And I think of my own novel, you know, Soho Sins, you know, not only do the characters encounter several big bad wolves along the way, but they also end up in a kind of Hansel and Gretel situation at the end. You know, it's not exactly a house in the forest, but it's something similar in an urban context and equally dangerous. You never know when they're going to end up in the oven.
You had finished the novel and then went looking for a publisher? Is that how it worked?
I had a full manuscript, quite long manuscript, and it was, at that point, in large part, a kind of comedy of manners, although comedy may seem like a peculiar word here, but a comedy of manners about the art world, a satire on the art world, with a crime element as a thread to keep the readers moving through the text. I, you know, passed it around here and there. But when I got the response from Charles Ardai, the publisher of Hard Case Crime, he said, you know, love, love, love this. But it's too damn long, and it's too diffuse. You know, you really need to decide what it is you want to do here. And I then sat back and decided that I wanted to do a straight-out murder mystery in the context of the art world. And that became a second graduate education in itself. I mean, not only is writing fiction incredibly different from writing criticism, editing that manuscript forced me to rethink the entire process, because now it's no longer about what you need to write or want to write. It's about what the reader needs. What do they need to know, and what do they need to feel at each step? So I ended up restructuring, cutting whole chapters, whole characters, roughing up the language, reducing it by 20%, and resubmitting and crossing my fingers. Now, Charles, the publisher, had said that he would give it a second read if I revised it. I know that he didn't expect me to succeed. Because writers almost never do under those circumstances. And I think he was surprised, but obviously pleased that, to his mind, I did succeed.
How long did that take you?
That took 6 months. I mean, the big revision took 6 months, yeah. Bearing in mind that, you know, I'm working full-time in an office and having a social life in the art world and traveling and doing critical writing at the same time. So some of it was done on airplanes and in hotel rooms in Shanghai. But wherever I could find, you know, a chunk of time to do it. It reminds me of something I learned long ago about writing criticism or writing in general. I used to agonize over writing, particularly over how to begin. Should this first sentence be like this, or should it be like that? Because this sets the tone for everything that follows. It sets the parameters. And then one day, I found myself in this situation where, you know, I had to write to deadline. It's like, okay, we need, you know, a piece on this show, and we need to buy this date. And I suddenly realized that for any piece of writing, there's six different ways to do it, there's six different ways to begin. Pick one, you know, and just do it. And they're, you know, they're all equally valid. You can make any of them work. In this particular instance with Soho Sins, it was finding the right tone. You know, I had tons of notes, and, you know, little outlines and what have you. But it didn't really begin until I wrote the correct opening sentence. And when I heard that sentence in my mind, it was like the pitchfork. I mean, the tuning fork going on. You know, that's the note. And once I had that note, you know, I could compose.
We look forward to hearing your thoughts on art and crime. I once met somebody in the in Central Park who was going to the Art Students League because he said, I wanted to learn how to do forgeries.
Well, we, you know, since I spend a lot of time in China, I'm very aware of the difference, the status of the copy in our two cultures. I mean, of course, there was a time in Western culture when the copy was a very important part of every student's education, the act of copying, and you know, you would go into museums and see people set up in front of great masterpieces. It's become, you know, more suspect to us under the influence of high modernism and the notion of perpetual originality. And but in China, the copy is still a very legitimate practice, which is sometimes put to illegitimate uses, obviously, because some of them end up on the market presented as originals. But I think that, you know, there's a great deal to be said for that practice of putting yourself through the same paces and the same processes that the master went through to achieve a particular end. You know. You know, you don't want to become just an epigon, you know, like reproducing the same kind of work that the master would have made. But I think you learn some deep-seated lessons by doing that. You know, much of writing is subliminal. And your understanding of a literary structure, your understanding of the dynamics of dialogue, your understanding of how to set a scene might not be in your conscious mind, but it is there based on the things that you've read in the past, based on the writing that you've done in the past. So there's something to be said for basing some of your student exercises on great models. It requires talent like anything else. You know?
Well, Richard Vine, thank you very much for coming.
My great pleasure to be here. And, I always tell my friends, think noir.
Thank you.
That was Richard Vine, who will be giving a talk, Art, Crime, and Soho Sins, at the school in Kinderhook on Saturday, August 6th, along with a book signing and a reception. You heard Willie Nelson and Patsy Cline doing a Willie Nelson song. Now here's Leonard Cohen.
I remember you well in the Chelsea Hotel. You were talking so brave and so sweet, giving me head on the unmade bed while the limousines wait in the street. Those were the reason that was New York. We were running for the money and the flesh, and that was called love for the workers in song. Probably still is for those of them left. Yeah, but you got away, didn't you, babe? You just turn your back on the crowd. You got a way I never once heard you say. I need you. I don't need you. I need you. I don't need you. and all of the jiving around. I remember you well in the Chelsea Hotel. You were famous, your heart was a legend. You told me again you preferred handsome men, but for me you would make an exception. And clenching your fist for the ones like us who are oppressed by the figures of beauty, you fixed yourself. You said, well, never mind, we are ugly, but we have the music. And then you got away, didn't you, baby? You just turned your back on the crowd. You got away, I never once heard you say, I need you, I don't need you, I need you, I don't need you, and all of that jiving around. I don't mean to suggest that I loved you the best. I can't keep track of each fallen robin. I remember you well in the Chelsea Hotel. That's all, I don't even think of you that often.